The increase of consumption goods called forth by that trade inevitably grew in its trade development of the productive power of the country. The industrial expansion required finance. What man in the first three quarters of the 18th century was better able to afford the ready capital than a West Indian sugar planter or a Liverpool slave trader?
When you grow up in the UK, you learn a lot about how the Industrial Revolution made Britannia rich and powerful, but at school, I learn a lot less about the role of the slave trade in that transformation. Recent research is changing that picture, but it's still an argument that is a long way from being settled. So today on Vox Talks Economics, slavery and the British Industrial Revolution. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. So remember to subscribe. Follow us on Instagram as well. If you thought that quote at the beginning was from a recent paper, well, think again. It was from a book called Capitalism and Slavery, and that was written in 1944, though it contained ideas that were so inflammatory that it was not published in the UK for another 20 years. The author was Eric Williams. He was a young Oxford economist at the time, and he went on to become the Prime Minister of Trinidad and Tobago. Well, his opinions are still controversial, and they're certainly not universally accepted. But now a new CEPR discussion paper provides support for the idea that slaveholding by Britons accelerated the Industrial Revolution. So how did the authors reach that conclusion? Well, two of them are with me now. Stefan Heblich of the University of Toronto and Joachim Voth of the University of Zurich. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Tim.
Joachim, what argument was Williams making about the link between capitalism and slavery in his work? Why was it so controversial?
I think it's probably safe to say that it's controversial for political reasons. First, because it suggests that there's a huge dark stain on the transition to self-sustaining growth. We, the West, are rich today because of a million-fold exploitation, the suffering imposed on Africans. Second, because it creates a potential case for reparations because of that. Intellectually, I think it's controversial because with the data that people had in the post-war world, you couldn't really resolve this issue. So we're in a much better position now because of recent data collection as a result of the Legacies of British Slavery's database compiled by researchers at UCL. And we can say a lot more about who exactly held slave wealth and who benefited.
And that's the story we're going to work through today. But first of all, the British involvement in the slave trade, how long did that go on for? Williams, at the beginning, he was talking about something called the triangular trade that made Britain rich. What was the triangular trade?
So maybe in order to start, we should go back when did slave trade really start. So allegedly, Britain's first involvement into the slave trade goes back to Sir John Hawkins, who was the cousin of Sir Francis Drake. Hawkins, I would say, was an aspiring sailor. He was born in Plymouth, trained to be in the trade. And on one of his first voyages to the Caribbean, he allegedly hijacked a Portuguese slave ship near Sierra Leone in West Africa and seized about 300 Africans who were enslaved at that time. And he brought them over to the West Indies, which are the Caribbean today, and sold them to Spanish plantations. Britain started planting its own Caribbean islands in the early 1600s, first with St. Kitts in 1623, then Barbados in 1627, and Nevis in 1628. So Britain's engagement officially into the slave trade started in around 1660, when King Charles II of England gave his brother James, the Duke of York, a royal monopoly to trade exclusively in gold and West African people. And this was the birth of the Royal African Company, which then held the monopoly until the Glorious Revolution in 1689. And with the 1697 trade of African trade was opened to all English merchants. Britain then dominated the slave trade in the 18th century. Between 1701 and 1807, British ships are estimated to have carried over 2.5 million enslaved Africans, which is more than one third of the overall number of 6 million who were totally transported at that time. And this number does not yet include all those who perished on the horrendous trip over. So with this short introduction, we can come to the actual slave triangle that you asked about. So British slave trade was concentrated in three British ports. 49% of the trade happened from Liverpool, 29% came out of London, and 21% out of Bristol, and the rest was kind of like marginal. So these were the origin ports of the slave triangle. Merchants brought from their textiles, iron products, and also arms on the first leg of the triangle over to West Africa, where they traded these industrial goods for enslaved Africans. On the second leg of the triangle, which was the so-called Middle Passage, this was the really horrendous part where the enslaved were transported under barbaric conditions from West Africa to the Caribbean. And on the last legs, ships transported the produce of the North Americas and the Caribbean slave economy back to Britain. And in the early 18th century, this was predominantly sugar, coffee, and tobacco, and rum, and later on, cotton was added to this last leg.
Williams is partly arguing in that quote that a Liverpool slave trader had plenty of spare cash to invest, and so that trader would invest it in industrialization. Given what we found out since, was he right about this?
He might have been, but we don't really know, okay? So follow the money is something that is exceedingly hard to do at a distance of 200 years.
Yes.
What quantitative historians like Engelmann have done is to provide pretty convincing evidence that the slave trade itself probably generated profits that were too small relative to the size of the British economy to really make a difference. Now, the thing that we find that is prominent in the historical narratives is that the slave trade doesn't directly map into industrial investment, but it's an important stepping stone in the slave economy. Why? Because it facilitates investment in slave plantations. So the standard career, often over several generations, is for people to get into the slave trade, to do well in it, and then transition into slave holding and often controlling vast plantations across various Caribbean islands, becoming very rich indeed, and then repatriating some of those profits to Britain.
I see. And that's why in this paper, you have investigated the impact of slave holding instead. Is that because just the sums of money are so much larger?
Yes. So there's an estimate or a calculation by Barbara Solo from 1993, who calculated that the profits from slave holding were an order of magnitude greater than the direct profits from the actual slave trade. So I think Joachim just mentioned that the slave trade, the profits were estimated to be in the range of 0.5% of GDP in the late 18th century. And she then estimates that the profits from slave holding are closer to 5% of GDP. And this is why we focus on the wealth from slave trading and holding together. And together they were large compared with domestic investments in Britain, which ran in around 7% at that time. So we argue that in our paper that the two facets of the slave economy, trading and holding together, they were closely linked. And as Joachim just said, individuals who successfully invested in slave trading initially, they learned about the profitability of the plantation economy and then started investing into this economy.
And to be clear, in your theory, how does this increase in wealth for slaveholders, how does it affect British manufacturing capacity?
Great question, Tim. So what's development? Development basically means to get people out of agriculture and into cities and factories. And that's the same in the last 100 years in lesser developed countries. And it was the same in industrializing Europe. And Britain during the Industrial Revolution had a lot of technologies. It also had capital that was super profitable. Now, we have this work by Allen that suggests that the rates of return on capital are very high. There's no accident that Marx wrote Das Kapital to describe how development works. But that's another way of saying that relative to the amount of capital out there, the opportunities are very great indeed. Now, what happens when you repatriate profits from the slave economy to Britain is that you relax some of that constraint of this sort of desperate thirst for capital, and you actually turn it into factories and working capital and imports and infrastructure, all of which facilitates development in that spot. And if you do enough of it, the whole country will start to look very different. And that's what our theory basically says, that there's this process of structural transformation and industrialization that is facilitated by helicopter drops of money coming from the slave economy.
Yeah. And in the paper, I can only admire the work you've done, because you have done this region by region, rather than just saying this was the total amount of money that went into the whole of Britain. It's extremely impressive, but it's a lot of work. So why did you do it that way?
The way you asked the question, we should first of all acknowledge that this was not just our work, but we greatly benefit here from the fantastic work of the Legacy of British Slavery Project at UCL.
Mm.
The historians have spent more than a decade to collect information on compensation payments from the 1833 Abolition Act, where everyone who received compensation for slavery was basically listed or registered. And we also then, from these records, go on and learn about family structures and locations. Maybe as a side aspect, I should mention that we indeed see in these records that slaveholders were compensated and not the actually enslaved people.
Mm.
This is a horrendous side issue here to mention, because back in the days when abolition came along, or when abolitionists were hoping to finish slavery for good, there was a strong understanding of property rights, and the enslaved were actually perceived back in the days as property.
Yes.
And as abolition went on, the only way to justify the expropriation of slaveholders was to actually pay them. And all these payments that were made to the slaveholders were listed in parliamentary papers, and this is the origin of the Legacy of British Slavery Project and the database they created. So we're using this database and we're benefiting from this database. The reason why we believe it's important to move to the regional level and to have a finer geography is that much of the existing work around the Williams debate or hypothesis has occurred at the level of the economy as a whole. And we believe that this is not an easy unit to deal with, right? You're looking at time series variation here, and this essentially means that you have like an observation of slave trade in, let's say, 1700, another one in the middle, then in 1800. And a lot of things can happen that you cannot disentangle in that time series variation. The alternative would be to look at cross-country variation, which some people did in the past, but again, this comes with its own problem. So in our case, the beauty is that we have here within country variation, which means that a lot of correlated events like the institutions, the aggregate economic cycles, the condition of the labor market are pretty much constant within a country, and we can then really focus at regional variation. So that is why exploiting geographical variation and slavery participation across regions within Britain enables us to focus on what we really want, which is variation and exposure to the slave economy without getting distracted by these other shocks that I mentioned.
And the amount of detail that we know about slaveholding and the profits from it, I have seen some of these records. They are extraordinarily detailed, aren't they? What information do we get from them?
Yeah, so this comes out of the compensation process that Stefan summarized. When Parliament decided to compensate the holders of slaves, you had to file for compensation, as you're going to lose your property in inverted commas as part of this horrific practice.
Yeah.
And the slavery database contains the names of 25,000 individuals and their addresses who received these 20 million in 1833 money, which, you know, in today's money would probably be 120 billion or something like that.
Gosh.
And there's a lot of interesting things about this. I mean, we map it in space, but you can also see the distribution of wealth invested in slaves. And there are some families that are very heavily involved and own an awful lot of wealth in terms of slaves.
Mm-hmm.
There's also quite a few who actually hold only one or two slaves. And it is rented out during harvest season or whatever. And then a broker in the Caribbean sends back the wages received from the labor of the enslaved people. And they could be mortgaged, for example. So there's just like a financial asset, a widows and orphans investment in Britain before 1833. And we basically piggyback on all this information in the Legacies of British Slavery database and then trace family histories of people receiving compensation to link them to the slave trade and the location of ancestors of the smoke traders.
And is this the reason why we can make this link from the earnings from slave holding to the Industrial Revolution? Because I would have thought a lot of people who held slaves would already be wealthy. So it would be hard to work out that it was slave holding wealth that was accelerating the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, Tim, I think you're pointing here to a very important point, and I think this is a key challenge in the existing debate about the Williams hypothesis. This is a chicken and egg problem, and in order to solve this problem, whether it was wealth that was driving the slave economy or the slave economy that generated wealth, we do two things. So first, we use data on economic activity before the rise of the slave economy. Specifically, we've undergone quite an effort to uncover property values in Britain dating back to the Doomsday Books. And using these data that provide spatial variation in property values, we show that locations that subsequently gained high or low slavery wealth were not differentially valued before the slave trading really started. And a second way to address this chicken and egg problem is to develop a new instrumental variable estimation strategy, which is based on the fact that many slave traders eventually became slaveholders. This is the sequence of events that Joachim pointed out earlier. And then when they became slaveholders, they were investing in the West Indian plantations. So we argue that in the age of sail, the idiosyncrasies that were underlying wind and weather conditions were heavily influencing the duration of the transatlantic voyage, which is the middle leg of the slave triangle that we mentioned earlier. On this middle passage, there were crowded and inhumane conditions, and these led often to high rates of mortality during this middle passage. And a primary determinant of the high mortality on the middle passage among the enslaved was how long the voyage took, because as voyage times increased, the unfavorable conditions on board led to infectious disease spreads, to raising mortality, and as a result of that, we would expect that slave traders would make lower profits on their voyages. Right. And so we would then expect that as some of the slave traders made lower profits, there's a lower probability that they make continuing investments into the slave trade initially, which then also decreases the probability that they would move on into slave holding. So the bottom line of the story is that we think that incremental weather shocks on these voyages themselves reduced wealth and also introduced exit from slave trade. And in that sense, we have a lower probability to observe in 1833 slaveholder wealth at the time of abolition. So we instrument 1833 slave wealth using voyage outcome measures that were inversely related to middle passage mortality.
And a final piece of this extraordinary piece of economic archaeology that you've done is to work out the effect on the economy region by region. We don't have GDP data for that. So what are we talking about the effect of this investment being?
Yeah, so we don't have an aggregate measure of economic activity, but we have indicators of how much the economy was producing in different parts of the country. So we have these land tax surveys, which we're using. There's data from the 1831 census, and we can look at how many people work in agriculture. That's a good indicator of how developed or undeveloped a part of the country is. And we glean information on, for example, the location of textile mills or steam engines from parliamentary reports. Reports, newspapers. So all of these things can be done, and that's the only way in which you can say anything sensible about regional economic development before 1930.
Fascinating. We'll be back after this.
One of our most popular episodes from 2022 discussed how trade between a colonial power and its dominions created a new wave of empires after the Industrial Revolution. Check out November's episode called How Empires Rise and How They Fall.
So we need to look at the results you've achieved from this. First of all, without the income from slavery, can we say how much poorer Britain would have been by the 1830s when it was abolished?
We have two parts in our paper. We have an empirical strategy, and then we have an economic theoretical model. And combining our model with the rich economic geographical data that I've mentioned before, we find substantial aggregate and distributional consequences of access to slavery investments. At the aggregate level, we find an increase in national income of at least 3.5%. This may not sound like much, but we are today, you know, 10 to 20 times richer than Britons in 1800. But back in the days, we should keep in mind that conventional estimates of the welfare gains from international trade have an upper bound of around 9% for instance, 19th century Japan. So the number is quite substantial. If we look across Britain, we find that access to slavery investments played an important role in shaping the geography of the Industrial Revolution. And this is consistent with our causal estimates using variation in middle passage mortality. The locations with the greatest level of participation in slavery investment experienced an increase in total income of more than 40%, with population increasing by about 6.5%, capitalists' income rising by more than 100%, and landlords' income declining by just over 7%.
Which regions did benefit the most from this?
It looks as if it's particularly the north of England that does the best out of this. Interesting, because there's basically a puzzle. Why does the economic geography of Britain change so much after 1750? And there's all sorts of theories about why the textile mills all end up in the north. And there's even theories that the air has to be sufficiently humid for the thread not to break when spindles spin and so forth. But we have a very natural interpretation for this, because we see that the places where slave traders come from, where they or their ancestors lived, are the ones where there's a lot of slave wealth, often 2-3 generations later, based on the 1833 records. And that is where a significant part of Britain's economic development is. That's where the textile mills are. That's where the steam engines are. That's where people are getting out of agriculture, doing other higher value added things. So that's what we are excited about. This puzzle of why does Britain's economic geography get transformed within 100 years seems to at least have a partial answer by this semi-random process of, you know, you get lucky in the slave trade, and where do you come from, where do you go back to, and those places then doing well.
Was it the capitalists that benefited from this, as you said, or did the whole population benefit?
Capitalists were surely the largest beneficiaries within, like, from our model, we could say that an increase in their annual income of about 11%, both because of direct income from slave capital invested in colonial plantations and because of the induced increase in steady state domestic manufacturing capital that we assume here. So landowners, compared to the capitalists, experienced small aggregate income losses of just under 1% because of the reallocation of labor away from agriculture. So we're basically observing a process of structural transformation from agriculture into manufacturing. Mm. And the expected worker welfare in Britain arose by about 3% because of the substantial wage increases in British locations that invested slaveholding wealth in manufacturing, and because of the positive probability of living in these locations following the structural transformation.
Is this a distinctively British narrative, or does it apply to, for example, the US as well?
Well, that's a super important question, Tim. The US is very different, because in the US, you have in the South not just slavery and some people getting rich from slavery, but you also have local slaveholding, with slaves providing the majority of work on many of these plantations, distorting the labor market. You have institutions set up to sort of sustain the system of slavery. And the net result of all these things in the US seems to be negative. So that's the current consensus. And then people look at our work and say, well, why is it so different in Britain? But in a way, you have a case of immaculate conception, if you will, where it's only the capital that travels, right? The institutions that exploit the slaves in the Caribbean, the labor market distortions in the Caribbean. But the money often comes back, and that is what makes all the difference. The second related question that people ask us is, Britain is not the only place that trades slaves. It's not the only place where people live who actually own quite a bit of overseas slave wealth. So why is it Britain that seems to benefit from this the most? Look at our model, there's a fairly straightforward answer. You basically need the seed corns of development. You need to have nuclei of economic transformation, which then get accelerated. It's like adding extra water to a plant that already wants to grow. But if you're Portugal, and there's none of this going on, the labor markets aren't tight, there's no real need for capital, there's nobody who can actually look after machines that could be profitable to operate, adding a bit of slave wealth does nothing. And if anything, it might even be negative, because you end up jacking up wages and then nobody can do something productive because your local nobility or whoever else is rich now has more cash in pocket and spends it on whatever tickles their consumption desires.
In the UK, we are just starting to discuss some of these links between slavery and economic development. There have been some statues taken down. There have been some streets renamed. It's still incredibly controversial, though. And some commentators, some economists, don't even accept that there is that link between capitalism and slavery. When I was reading around about this, I came across this quote, which I'm going to read to you. Had the slave trade never existed, the nation's economic history would barely be altered. Is the economist that wrote that wrong?
Brings us back to some earlier part of our discussion. This quote specifically focuses on the slave trade. Mm-hmm. And as we mentioned, we're looking not just at the slave trade, but the overall slave economy, also including slave holding. On a more broader picture, Britain's escape from the Malthusian horrors was for sure a close-run thing at that time. So surging population could have easily spelled a collapse in living standards and development. But instead, we see that the period between 1750 to 1830 saw the transition to self-sustaining growth. And so this, despite enormous population growth, average incomes surged at that time. The country became properly industrialized in a way that it has never been before. And at the same time, its economic geography changed radically in the period between 1700 and 1900. So what we do is we offer a unified interpretation for both these sets of related changes, the aggregate performance, but also the regional divergence in the performance. So coming back to the initial question, is slavery all that we know about the Industrial Revolution in Britain? Surely not, right? There were other factors. There was technology was improving at that time. Markets worked reasonably well. The government taxation was much less distortionary than elsewhere. And there was also a lot of skills around in Britain at that time. What we really say in this paper is that slavery, far from being just a marginal rounding error, if you like, was potentially one big contributor to output growth, which led to a more capitalist, more urban economy that was centered on manufacturing locations in the North at that time.
There's so much we could talk about this, and I'm sure this is not the last conversation we'll be having about it. But both of you, thank you very much for talking to me about it today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tim, for having us.
The paper is called Slavery and the British Industrial Revolution, and the authors are Stefan Heblich, Stephen Redding, and Joachim Both.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the best new research in economics every week, so subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, why not leave a review? Next week on Vox Talks, how to rebuild Ukraine's labor market.